Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
You'd normally find me introducing a full-on Science Weekly podcast here right now, but because it's nearing summer, we're on a break for 4 weeks. We'll be back properly on July the 6th, and every week until then, we're going to bring you a different interview or item, a taster of the kinds of things we do on the podcast. This week, we have Michio Kaku, a professor of physics at the City University of New York and an expert in string theory. He's also a futurist trying to work out how the science of today will become the technology of the future, which bits of science fiction will eventually become fact. His latest book is Physics of the Impossible, a guide to everything from time travel to teleportation, and why so many things that might seem magical today might become physically real someday soon. He came into The Guardian to explain his ideas further, and I began by asking him how he classified what was impossible.
Well, believe it or not, about 80% of what you see in Star Trek and Star Wars with force fields and things like invisibility, teleportation, starships even, are possible in the coming decades to maybe a century. I call them class one impossibilities, things that are coming very soon, like invisibility, for example. Class two takes longer, maybe centuries to millennia. Believe it or not, they include things like time travel, warp drive, interdimensional travel. And class three impossibilities apparently are just downright impossible. Perpetual motion machines, for example, violate all the known laws of physics. So we would have to change physics if class three impossibilities become possible.
Okay, well, we'll come into those a little bit. The idea of changing physics is not so impossible, actually, is it? If you think about where we were in the 19th century and the 20th century.
Yeah, during the Victorian age, Lord Kelvin said many, many things are impossible. He said airplanes are impossible. He said x-rays are impossible. And a lot of the impossibilities of the Victorian age now, of course, are commonplace.
Well, let's go into some of those class one and two impossibilities that you're knocking down. Force fields, ray guns, things like time travel. This is the staple of science fiction stuff. First of all, are you a fan of science fiction? Is that what got you into this?
Yeah, when I was a child, I used to watch the old Flash Gordon series on TV, and I was mesmerized. That was the first time I was exposed to starships and aliens and ray guns. And I learned something, though, watching Flash Gordon. I learned that it was the scientist who made the whole series work. Without the scientist, there was no Flash Gordon.
Dr. Zarkov, in that case.
That's right.
He's the one who's the evil genius, though, usually. But things like force fields. I mean, as a kid, I've always imagined having force fields. Tell us where the force fields are in the world.
Well, they would have to be multi-layered because one kind of force field is not going to repel ray guns and rocks and bows and arrows. However, a plasma wall has already been invented by a scientist at Brookhaven National Laboratories in New York. It's a wall of hot gas that separates the air of a rocket ship from the vacuum of outer space, just like the airlock in Star Trek. It even glows blue, just like the force field in Star Trek. But it has to be reinforced with, for example, a web of carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes are stronger than steel. The fibers are almost invisible, and you could have basically an invisible cloth stronger than steel that could stop bullets to reinforce your plasma shield. Then you would have to have a crisscross of laser beams to vaporize things as they go through. So a multi-layered force field is definitely possible.
Well, that kind of makes sense to me. But something else in your class one impossibilities is psychokinesis, this idea that you can move things by thought alone. That must be impossible.
No. In fact, we already have primitive forms of it in the laboratory. Okay, first of all, at Brown University in Rhode Island, they took a stroke victim who was paralyzed, put an electrode in his brain, and then hooked the electrode to a laptop computer. And in a few hours, he's manipulating the cursor on the screen. He's totally paralyzed. He can now do crossword puzzles. He can surf the web. He can answer emails and respond to emails. In the future, we too may have an almost invisible electrode connected to our brain and surf the web just by daydreaming and looking out the window. Not only that, but we can also read thoughts now to a degree. Using fMRI scans, you can actually see the blood flow of the human brain to tell, for example, that they're lying. When you tell the truth, your brain lights up a little bit. But when you tell a lie, your brain lights up like a Christmas tree because you have to know the truth, the cover-up, the consequences of the cover-up. That takes a lot of brain power.
Actually, hearing you talk about this makes me realize, I mean, all of that absolutely makes sense, stuff that we've actually reported on in this show and in the paper a lot, this idea of helping stroke victims and people who are paralyzed or even in comas communicate using just thoughts. And actually studying fMRI scans of the brain is an incredible new area of physics and biology. But in a sense, what you're doing is redefining the question slightly. So psychokinesis, in a science fiction sense, is some magical thing that allows someone to move a cup across a room. But you're giving it a real physical basis using, you know, radio waves or magnetic resonance imaging.
Right. In other words, somebody who is a born telepath, we don't think that's possible because the human brain does not generate enough electromagnetic radiation in order to move objects around the room. However, mechanically enhanced telepathy and psychokinesis is possible. And for example, in Japan, already they've been able to create a dictionary of thought that when you think about a boy, a cat, or a dog, it lights up a characteristic pattern on your brain, and you can actually read these thoughts and identify what you are thinking about. Right now, the vocabulary is rather small, maybe 20, 30 words, but in the future, it'll be several thousand words. And so we'll be able to essentially identify what you are thinking about using fMRI scans, combining that with electrodes to the brain, combining that with what is called paramagnetism, whereby you can actually move non-magnetic materials. Then you would have something that is extremely close to the power of a magician or the power of a god. That is the ability to move things by thinking about it.
You also need quite good sort of judgment in that case, wouldn't you, in case you do something terrible.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if you've seen Bruce Almighty, but all sorts of terrible things happen when people are given godlike abilities. Okay, one more class one impossibility is teleportation. We know that individual atoms can be teleported from one piece of scientific equipment to another. What's the latest on that front?
Well, we're actually filming this book for the Science Channel and also ITV television. Just 2 weeks ago, we went to the University of Maryland and actually photographed what happens when you teleport an atom. We put an atom in one chamber and a meter away, a second chamber, and zap, we just teleported the atom right across. So photons, particles of light, have been teleported up to 600 meters. That's the world's record for teleporting a photon. Atoms of cesium, rubidium, and deuterium have now been teleported. Next will be molecules. We'll start to teleport water and carbon dioxide. And we'll teleport up to the space shuttle, to outer space. After 2020, we'll be on the moon. Perhaps we'll start to teleport to the moon as well. But maybe a virus within a few decades. Genes, DNA, a virus could probably be teleported. But a human body consists of 50 trillion cells. So that may take several centuries before we get that far. But then again, Star Trek takes place in the 23rd century. So we still have a few centuries to go before we can teleport an entire human being. But the very fact that we can do it at all is incredible. Because just 10 years ago, many physicists said that teleportation is physically impossible. In fact, there were articles written saying that it's physically impossible. And now we do it on the atomic level.
The atomic teleportation, what kinds of uses would it be? It's nice to be able to do it, or maybe even teleport a virus. What would be the point of doing it?
Well, eventually, we want to be able to do exactly what you see in Star Trek. That is, zap objects across space and time. And that could, of course, revolutionize society. Can you imagine, for example, just teleporting yourself to work and not having to commute? Or just teleporting yourself to any of the luxury resorts for a vacation? It'll change everything if teleportation is really possible.
Good for climate change, I guess, as long as it don't use lots of energy.
Oh, definitely. It could revolutionize the way we view fossil fuels. We wouldn't have to have fossil fuels to go from A to B.
Let's get into the more delicious impossibilities of class two. This is faster than light travel and time travel. Class two, according to your definition, is things that are physically possible. I mean, they're allowed by the laws of physics, but we just don't know how to do them or have any concept of how to do them. I mean, I was always taught that faster than light travel was impossible. It was always impossible. Einstein said that, didn't he?
Not really. First of all, empty space can stretch and contract faster than the speed of light. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light, nothing being empty space. So instead of going to Alpha Centauri, why don't you let Alpha Centauri come to you? That is, compress the space between you and a star, and then you simply hop across. That solution was found in Einstein's equations just 10 years ago. This is relatively new, that we now have a solution of Einstein's equations that allow for faster-than-light travel. So this is because space, empty space, can be compressed faster than light. So then you can zap across enormous distances by simply sitting still and doing nothing. So the catch, though, however, there's always a catch, is that the fuel necessary to drive a starship like this requires negative energy and negative matter. These are very exotic things. But just last week at Harvard, we took a film crew and photographed physicists at Harvard University who were actually creating tiny quantities of negative energy in the laboratory. So this is not science fiction, but to harvest enough for a starship would require several centuries. So in the future, perhaps centuries from now, warp drive, time travel may become possible.
So is something like that and your next Class 2 impossibility, time travel, are they engineering problems rather than science problems?
In fact, that's the whole theme of the book, that what we usually consider impossible are nothing but engineering problems. Now, they're very big engineering problems. You're talking about, for Class 2, manipulating the power of a star. But again, physics says they are possible, or at least they seem to be possible, and there's no law of physics preventing them. Stephen Hawking, for example, once thought that time travel was impossible because where are the tourists from the future? Well, he's changed his mind. He now says that time travel is possible. Doesn't seem to violate any laws of physics. So where are the time travelers from the future? Maybe they're invisible.
That's a class one impossibility, so we'll get to that much quicker than the time travel itself. One theme that seems to run through the book from the beginning is that this is a study not just of technology and engineering and science, it's a study of what we define as impossible. And this is it's a sliding scale. As we mentioned earlier, the 19th century, you had people like great scientists like Lord Kelvin talking about how we've discovered everything there is to discover. Now it's just, the rest of it is just more detail. He was entirely wrong about airplanes and all sorts of things. Would that be fair to say that this book is all about the relativity of impossibility?
That's right. We think that what is impossible is relative, that if you wait long enough, decades, centuries, a millennia, then things that normally we would consider preposterous become possible. And the purpose of the book is to rank them, to show you when the impossible becomes possible. Now, how confident are we about these predictions? Realize that we have two great theories of physics. We have relativity, the theory of the very big, black holes and big bangs. Then we have the theory of the small, that is the quantum theory. And we see no deviation from either of these two theories. And so we can say with reasonable confidence, using relativity and using the quantum theory, that the predictions of this book, in fact, are consistent with everything we know about the laws of physics. Now, you may say, well, what about a theory beyond relativity and beyond the quantum theory? That requires string theory, which is beyond these two disciplines. And that's actually what I do for a living.
I was going to come to this. Your particular field is string theory. This idea that you can unify all the four fundamental forces of matter in some way and come up with a final theory. So all the while we've talked about how things that seem impossible become possible and that there is no end to physics, but could that be the end for physics?
I think so. In fact, this summer at the Large Hadron Collider, when it's turned on again, we will begin to test aspects of string theory. String theory is very testable. And it is, as you mentioned, quote, the final theory, we think. We hope to create sparticles with the Large Hadron Collider. Sparticles are superparticles. They represent the next set of vibrations of a tiny rubber band. And we hope to find them with the Large Hadron Collider. And string theory deals with this book because string theory has within it the capability to settle these questions about time travel, about higher dimensions, like up to 11 dimensions, and the question of warp drive. String theory right now is not developed enough, because it's very complicated theory, it's not developed enough to settle these questions, but apparently it does seem to allow for time travel and for warp drive.
How do we know that there's nothing beyond string theory, though?
We don't. We just know that we have these two great theories, the theory of the big, the theory of the small, and to put them together is notoriously difficult. So far, string theory is the only theory which allows you to blend the quantum theory and relativity.
Your book, the preface starts with a quote from Einstein, which I quite liked. He says, if at first an idea does not sound absurd, then there's no hope for it, which kind of talks about the physicists at this edge of knowledge. If you want to know something that is at the edge of knowledge, you've got to kind of play around a little bit and get things wrong, which is perhaps for most people who don't come across scientists often, a very odd way of doing science. Surely science is a steady march of things that are correct, backed up by experiments.
Yeah, what you learned in school about how science progresses step by step is totally wrong. people at the cutting edge of physics make leaps of logic. They make crazy ideas, and then they go out and see whether these ideas make any sense. So with this book, we're filming it, as I mentioned, and we're going into the laboratories, and we're talking to the scientists who are dreaming of warp drive, dreaming of invisibility. And talking to them, you see immediately that these people are not, quote, the usual scientists that you see on television with the smock and painfully mixing tubes. These are visionaries. These are people who make leaps of logic based on what we know today, and they have laboratories to back up what they say. And so these are the visionaries who are going to give us the science fiction of the future.
How do we sort of distinguish between stuff that is absurd but will eventually get us somewhere and the stuff which is just absurd?
Well, I get a lot of stuff in the mail, okay? People who say they've seen flying saucers, been abducted, have their version of relativity. And it's very easy to see what's wrong in the sense that if someone claims to be the next Einstein and you just look at their work, well, it has to include all of Einstein's theory because it's not wrong, it's maybe incomplete, and the quantum theory. And by opening up these proposals I get in the mail, you see almost immediately it's just words. It's just psychobabble. And you realize there's no equations to back this up. That's how you separate the two. The people who are serious understand the math. They understand Einstein's theory. They understand the quantum theory. And they build from there to dream about time travel and warp drive, rather than simply putting a lot of fancy words together with no equations and claiming that they've invented a time machine in their basement.
Actually, talking of inventing things in basement, one of the chapters in your book, it talks about how you yourself got into science. There's a really interesting story in there about how you built a particle accelerator in your garage. Now, I've done experiments when I was a kid too, but usually they involve things like putting vinegar into sodium bicarbonate and making a sort of pretend volcano. But you actually built a particle accelerator. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I did two experiments. One was to create antimatter and photograph antimatter when I was about 16 years old.
Yeah, I didn't do that.
Right. And the next year, I wanted to create my own source of antimatter when I was 17. So I built a 2.3 million electron volt betatron particle accelerator. And the magnetic field was so intense that it would rip the fillings out of your teeth if you got too close to my machine. I would blow out the circuit breakers in my mom's house, and all the fuse boxes would blow out.
You built it at home. This is not in any sort of lab somewhere.
Well, I got the equipment from Westinghouse, old transformer steel, 22 miles of copper wire, 400 pounds of transformer steel. It consumed 6 kilowatts of power. And I built it basically in the garage. And luckily, I got a scholarship to Harvard as a consequence.
But fortunately, there were no accidents there.
No accidents. Now, we're thinking back on it now. 6 kilowatts of power is enough to kill you. So I now realize that I should have been a little bit more careful when I was 17 years old.
Okay, well, shall we wind up with some of the things which are actually impossible? Even in your book, Class 3 Impossibilities, this would require a completely fundamental change in physics. This includes staples such as perpetual motion machines and precognition. People, you laugh at people who say, I've got a perpetual motion machine. And once a year, at least, someone comes up with this idea and says, I've got it and I'm going to change the world. And, you know, if they'd had, that would be brilliant. We'd solve so many of the world's problems. But unfortunately, thermodynamics seems to be quite hard to break. Tell us why you think these things are impossible, bearing in mind, of course, that impossible is relative.
Well, first of all, the Wall Street Journal and also the Economist, Financial Times, all of them have profiled the work of these inventors in their garage who claim to get energy from nothing. They're going to solve the energy crisis, and they get millions of dollars from investors, from automobile companies, millions of dollars of investment money. And the Wall Street Journal wants a quote. So I quote from P.T. Barnum, who once said, quote, there's a sucker born every minute. And the reason for that is that we see no deviation from the conservation of energy. And when I was a graduate student getting my PhD in physics, I finally understood the reason why. If the laws of physics do not change with time, the laws of physics are time invariant, then energy is automatically conserved. This is called Noether's theorem. And the laws of physics haven't changed in billions of years. Now, how do I know that? By analyzing starlight from stars billions of light years from the Earth. The starlight is identical to light that we get from the sun 8 minutes ago. And so the laws of physics haven't changed in billions of years. And that's how we can say with confidence that energy is conserved over billions of years.
But these two things you mentioned, perpetual motion machines, of course, they do seem impossible. But one thing, a question I have about precognition is that the more we understand about the human brain, the more we know that actually all of our thoughts and things that we do are prefigured in the brain, maybe a few microseconds, there's a few seconds even before we do them. This raises all sorts of philosophical questions, of course, about free will. But will there not be a time when you will be able to predict what someone is thinking or doing?
But precognition, of course, is seeing the future. That is, like Cassandra, seeing the fall of Troy, being able to predict the lottery and being able to win in Las Vegas. That's the real precognition. Now, time travel, on the other hand, seems to allow for precognition. But actually, it doesn't. Time machines actually are causal in the sense that time is a river. The river can speed up or slow down. But the river of time, we now realize, can also fork into two rivers. So if you were to jump stream from one river of time to the other branch of the river of time, you could meet yourself as a child. That doesn't mean you have precognition, because that child that you just met that looks just like you as a child, genetically equivalent to you, is really you in a parallel universe. It's really you in another time stream. So it's not really precognition at all. It's causal. There is cause and effect, that you think you know your child self's future, but actually you don't. Because by entering his universe, you've changed his future. So causality is still maintained, even if you have a time machine.
What is the future for this sort of area? What will remain impossible, and what do you think we're going to find is just our primitive society thinking something is impossible when it isn't?
Well, I think in the next few decades, we're going to have a shock, an existential shock, realizing that a lot of what you see on the silver screen are going to enter everyday life. Invisibility is being developed very fast now. Many, many groups around the world are jumping onto the bandwagon. And also teleportation on a small scale is moving very fast. Telepathy, mind reading, that's very well developed, especially in Japan. And so we're going to see products entering the marketplace, just like cell phones are the communicators of Star Trek. And when you see old reruns of Star Trek, you laugh because their computers are so primitive. And that's supposed to be the 23rd century. And you see cell phones. So I think in the next coming decades, we're going to see a lot of these things entering the marketplace.
That was Michi Yokaku, professor of physics and one of the inventors of string theory. Science Weekly will be back in full on July the 6th, but until then, you can follow the latest science news on our website, that's at guardian.co.uk/science, or on Twitter, just look for Guardian Science. Until next week, when we'll bring you another morsel from our travels in science, it's goodbye. This show was produced by Pascal Wise. I'm Alok Jha.